Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work.
Well, thank you. That was a very kind introduction. It is true that I just became dean, and a lot of people are saying, what's it like to be a woman dean? I've never been a man dean, so I haven't really been able to answer that too well. But anyway, so here I am, and it's a real pleasure and a real honor to be here with you as well. And just to get out of the way, I do get called Dr. Mosquito quite a bit. As far as I know, I'm not transmitting any viruses, so I think we're okay there. So here's what I'm going to try and do with you in the next 30 minutes. I'm going to talk for about 30 minutes, and then we'll have time for Q&A. What I'm going to do is talk to you about a few terms, trends, and concepts, a little bit about aging, but not entirely about aging, although I do say as a geriatrician, I have the only medical specialty people want to actually get to. So I'm going to talk a little bit about disability and aging, homelessness, and family violence. And these are all areas where I've done quite a bit of work. And then I want to spend the last 5 or 10 minutes of my talk talking to you about a few ideas. I mean, this was really a remarkable opportunity for me to talk to grantmakers in health. I feel like I'm a poster child a little bit about the role that foundations can have for an individual's career and what then impact that person may be able to have on other people as well. So that's the game plan. So fasten your seatbelts, because I'm going to move through this pretty quickly, because it's not so much the numbers I want you to get, it's more the concepts. So the idea will be just to throw out a few maybe trends and concepts that maybe you haven't been thinking about that might tickle your fancy, and then talk about a few ideas at the end. So let's start by talking a little bit about disability and aging. And one thing to remind people about is disability is really an umbrella term. And one thing we talk about first is the idea of impairment. And impairment is something that happens in mind or body. And in this case, I'm showing you a cartoon graphic of a spinal cord injury. That's an impairment. When it now limits your ability to get around, for example, in this case, this person is now in a wheelchair and has limited mobility, now we're talking about being able to get out and about. Finally, if we now have your inability to fulfill your social roles, so for example, you can't get out and get up these stairs, we now talk sometimes about a handicap or difficulty with participation in your usual roles. And this is important because sometimes we talk about handicapped people, but a lot of folks now are saying, and actually for a long time, that there's no such thing as a handicapped person, only handicapping societies. And as you'll see with trends related to disability, this is going to become more and more important, and the intersection with health is going to become more and more important. So disability is something that can be present at birth and then affect functions later in life, and we'll talk about Down syndrome a little bit more in a minute. It can be associated with developmental conditions. I think a lot of us have been hearing about autism lately, and we really don't know what's happening now in middle age and late life related to autism. Although I have to tell you just one recent story from my own practice of a guy who is 40 years old and has autism, but had never really been diagnosed and was really struggling with work. He was working at Disneyland, and they were fantastic working with me to help him find a role that really could work for him. And so he was no longer handicapped, even though he had autism, because he was able to fulfill his social role. Disability can be related to injury, like a traumatic brain injury or a spinal cord injury. It can be associated with long-standing chronic health conditions, like diabetes and rheumatoid arthritis. And disability isn't just one monolithic thing. Even for an individual person, it might be progressive, it might be static, it might be intermittent, as happens with multiple sclerosis. So there's a lot to think about when we're talking about disability issues. And when we think about age distribution, of course, we tend to concentrate on older adults, and we will in just a moment. But I also want to talk about younger people with disabilities, because this is now the first time in history that people who are born with a disability or who acquire a disability at a young age are now living in a middle age and older age. It's never happened before. And I've had some remarkable stories from my own practice related to this, and I'll tell you one or two in just a moment. So let's just talk about kind of the prototypical congenital issue that we talk about, which is Down syndrome, because it is the most common chromosomal abnormality. And most people have cognitive delays that are mild to moderate. Some have very severe. But the life expectancy for somebody with Down syndrome just in the past 30 years has more than doubled. More than doubled. But I still want you to note that even though we're doing better, and it's 60 now, it still isn't the same as for people who do not have Down syndrome. But the increase has been remarkable. And what we're going to talk about in just a minute is the impact this has not only on the individual, but on their families as well. Sometimes what we talk about with Down syndrome and with other disabling conditions like cerebral palsy is this idea of accelerated aging. That people will have in young adulthood or middle age issues that we typically associate with the older age groups, but they have it sometimes 30 years earlier. Problems with sensory loss, problems with arthritis. For people with Down syndrome, there's a lot of issues that happen in the neck area. The atlantoaxial instability is what that refers to. Problems with bone density loss at very early ages. Alzheimer's disease, probably a lot of you have heard that people with Down syndrome have a much higher rate of getting Alzheimer's disease when they're only in their 40s. But what we need to be careful about, and this is very important when it comes to healthcare, is that we tend to make assumptions. We see somebody with Down syndrome, they start to have a cognitive decline. Well, we know that people with Down syndrome are more likely to get Alzheimer's disease. That's what it is. But I now, in my practice, have seen several people where their thyroid function wasn't checked, and it turned out that what they had was problems with their thyroid function, another common illness in people with Down syndrome. And when we corrected their thyroid, their cognition came back to baseline. So we really need to be careful about this intersection of health and disability. I do want to get back, though, and talk about the age distribution of disability. And of course, this tends to occur mostly in the older age groups. And we tend to lump people over the age of 65 into the older age group. But as we know, people now in their 60s and 70s are actually doing quite well. So if we break it out a little bit more into these decades of 65 to 74, and then 75 to 84, and then 85 and above, you'll see that 3/4 of people between the ages of 65 and 74 have no disability whatsoever, whereas 3/4 of people over the age of 85 have some type of disability. But I think just as important is, it's not just one disability, but what we find is that as you get older, you're more likely to have multiple disabilities. So by the time we're looking at people over the age of 85, almost half have 3 or more conditions that cause disability. And this is very significant for a variety of reasons. Again, I'm a family physician. You're going to hear me talk about families and impact on families, the need for caregivers for personal sorts of what we call ADLs or activities of daily living goes from 3% in the 65 to 74 year age group to 22% in the over 85. So again, big impact on families, and as we'll talk about, big impact on issues like family violence as well, unfortunately. And this is why one recurring theme you'll hear from me is this lifespan view. When we talk strictly just about the disability issue, it's at the person, family, and societal level. There's a family who I had been seeing, a woman, she was in her 80s, and she had told me about her daughter who was at home who I never met, and she mentioned that her daughter had cerebral palsy. And not until this woman became very, very ill, and it was hard for her to come in and see me, she ended up with a metastatic pancreatic cancer, and I went to do a house call on her. And I went to the home, and what I had never realized, even though I had known her for 2 years, is that her daughter with cerebral palsy was so disabled that she was living in a hospital bed in their living room. And now that her mom was so ill, all of her healthcare decisions for mom related to treatment of her cancer completely revolved around the impact this was having on her daughter. And this is a woman who had spent her whole life keeping her daughter out of institutions, away from government, handling everything on her own. And now, as she was at the end of life, she always assumed she would outlive her daughter. And that, of course, was not the case. And in fact, when my patient died, her daughter died just a month later. They almost were one person. And I tried so hard to find a facility that would take both of them, and I never could. That still is a real heartbreak for me. But we were able to keep them home together until the very end. So health and health care play a very crucial role in people as they age with disabilities and in the families who are aging with disabilities as well. I'm going to turn now and just completely skip topics to homelessness and health, partly because this is an area where I've been really doing a lot more work myself. I've been working with a group of students, and we started an urgent care clinic in some homeless shelters downtown Los Angeles. You may be aware of some of the numbers. When we go to bed tonight, there will be more than 500,000 people in this country who do not have a home. And about 175,000 of these people are what are called unsheltered. They have enough mental health problems that they won't even come into a shelter even if one is available for them. And it's very hard for them then to access health care. What was really remarkable to me when the Affordable Care Act was up and operating well is when I would go to a homeless shelter, even though people didn't have a place to live, they knew who their primary care physician was. But now we have people who are unsheltered who really are unable to access care because of their own mental health problems. I was just in a homeless shelter last week, and I saw a gentleman who had stuffed leaves and twigs into his ear. This was related to voices who were telling him to do that. And so, you know, as a physician, I can take that stuff out of his ear, but that really isn't treating what the health problem is it? So we're going to have to get a little bit deeper than we have been. And one thing that we're aware of now is life expectancy for people who are homeless is probably around 45 years. We don't have really great data on this. In fact, there's very little good data on homelessness, and especially for people who are living on the street who are unsheltered. But we know that there are very high rates of chronic illnesses, a lot of people with mental health disorders, and many who also have drug use disorders. We're going to have to address all of these things simultaneously in order to help people have better health. Top three causes of death, certainly drug overdose, but cancer and heart disease as well. One thing I'm noticing with some of the work I'm doing in the shelters is I'll meet somebody who's 40 years old, and you would absolutely think they were well into their 60s. It's a very, very hard life. It's important for us to remember that many people who were homeless have suffered trauma earlier in their lives or even while they've been in the shelter. There are very high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder in people who are homeless. Many of the women I talk to at the women's shelter have suffered from sexual assaults from childhood and during young adulthood. Some of you may have read a book called The Body Keeps the Score, which is a wonderful book that talks about the effect of trauma on our physiology. And so we know that early trauma has all sorts of negative effects. We'll talk about the ACEs, which many of you are familiar with, in just a moment when it comes to family violence. But we see this a lot in the homeless population. We're now doing some work in street medicine and have just started a street medicine program to see if we can help some of our unsheltered homeless in Los Angeles get access to health care. And so we're just setting this up now. And this all started with foundation funding actually in Allentown, Pennsylvania, where I went and learned about some work that was being done. And we've brought some of that work to Los Angeles. What are the opportunities I have now as a dean of a school of medicine is to start thinking bigger about pipeline programs. What can we do to prepare healthcare providers so that we'll be able to provide care for people who are homeless and who are on the street? What are the research opportunities here so that we start to get to the root causes and actually move more towards prevention and early intervention? So I'm going to skip now and move over to trauma and family violence as another trend to have on your radar. Again, I like to think about this across the lifespan. We talk a lot about childhood trauma. We know that almost half of children in the United States have experienced at least one adverse childhood event. It's quite heartbreaking right now to think about the 10,000 children who've been separated from parents and to think about what trauma this is now going to have on them lifelong as we know more and more data regarding these sorts of issues. More than 20% of children have experienced two or more traumas. And what we know from the adverse childhood experience studies is that there's sort of a what we call a dose-response relationship, which is the more traumas you've suffered, the more poor health outcomes you're likely to have as you get into middle age. This has actually changed the way I practice medicine now. And just recently, I was seeing a new patient who's 92 years old, and I do what I always did, is I asked if, during our first visit, have you ever experienced any violence or significant traumas in your life? And it just came pouring out of this man. Some horrible traumas he suffered during childhood and had never talked about. He now is in counseling. He told me just last week that he feels like a weight has been lifted off of his shoulders, that he had this opportunity to talk about it. And his blood pressure is getting better. And, you know, all these things that he was on medication for, we might be able to now start pulling away in order to help him heal where he really needs to heal. So we know that adverse childhood experiences can have very lasting effects on people's health. And partly it's because on our health behaviors. If you tend to smoke or you don't take good care of yourself when you have diabetes, we know that it has effects on life potential, everything from graduation rates to academic achievement. Really important to understand the lasting impact of these effects. If we now move into adulthood and talk about interpersonal violence, we know that this is shockingly common. I haven't put the rates up for people with disabilities, but rates of sexual assault and violence for people with disabilities are absolutely astounding. But we know that many people who actually suffer injuries as a result of interpersonal violence never seek medical care. They're either too threatened, they're ashamed, they don't have access, a whole variety of reasons. And we know that there's a real tie between having suffered a trauma and homelessness as well, just to tie it back into our last section. The health impacts, again, of interpersonal violence, a whole host of medical problems. This person who keeps coming in and they're still having stomach pain and it just isn't getting better, just isn't getting better. I still remember vividly a woman I was seeing, and she only spoke Vietnamese. And she came in and been going around with horrible swallowing problems. And she had received all sorts of extensive workups related to the swallowing problems. I didn't want to reinvent the wheel. I saw all the data, the studies, nobody could figure out what was going on. It was very interesting. We used a translator over the phone, and it almost separated her from me a little bit. And we were able to have a conversation a little bit indirect, and I started asking about childhood trauma. And it turned out that she had had severe sexual assault repeatedly as a child, had never talked about it before. She then got into some counseling and therapy, and her whole swallowing problem went away. That was after, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of workup. It all related back to the childhood trauma that she had suffered. She was a remarkable and very brave woman. So the health impacts are sometimes quite unexpected and things that we need our colleagues in the health areas to really know about. It isn't just the broken bone. It's what happens to our psyches as well. I'm going to turn now for just a minute to elder abuse and neglect, which is an area where I do quite a bit of work. We know that the numbers are astounding. About 1 in 10 older adults will experience some form of abuse during old age. But if you have a dementing illness like Alzheimer's disease, we have data showing that about half of people with a dementing illness will be exposed to some form of violence or abuse at some point. So the numbers are really quite astounding. The impact, of course, of abuse and neglect are things like premature death, disability, depression, hospitalization, nursing home placement. It's a little bit sad, but it's true. I understand that one of the arguments we have to make in the elder abuse is just how costly it is that people have early need to go into nursing homes, which is very costly, end up in the hospital, et cetera. And I understand we have to make the cost argument, but still keep in mind that there's a much more compelling moral argument related to all of this as well. I'm a volunteer long-term care ombudsman, and so I also have had the opportunity to go into nursing homes, not as a doctor or geriatrician or any of that, but just as a volunteer long-term care ombudsman, and see kind of the atmosphere that people are in and how dehumanizing it can be for people. And there was somebody I was seeing not long ago, just doing my visits on, and his big plea is he just wanted to get a shave. He was used to being clean shaven. So while that is not something I would escalate to saying it's elder abuse or neglect, it's just the way we treat people, right? And it's making sure that everybody gets the dignity and respect that they deserve, particularly as we grow old. So when I look across the spectrum, it's amazing how many recurring themes there are related to family violence, so that if you're not segmenting it into different age groups, But caregivers who have mental health or substance abuse disorders, people who have disabilities are very high risk for being abused. Economic stressors, which really concerns me when we look at where we're going right now in this country, where there's just a greater divide than ever between the haves and have-nots. And then social isolation, people who just don't have any social support, or they don't have good social support or good relationships. There are also risk factors there. We had published a couple of years ago something called the AIM, the Abuse Intervention Model, which was just a way to help me try to package what was going on and to simplify how to understand and look at risk factors for abuse and neglect. What are the risk factors, in this case, of the older adult, but it could be in a child as well. I actually think this model can apply to all forms of family violence. What are the risk factors of the person who might be being abused? What are the risk factors of the person who might be doing the abuse? And what is the context in which everything is happening? And very often, when you put it into those three buckets, you can begin to understand not only what kind of abuse is going on, but you actually might now start to move toward how to ameliorate it. Sometimes you can't make abuse go away. You want to keep families together, or you know, somebody has capacity and doesn't want to move out of an abusive situation, but you can bring it down from a boil to a really low simmer and really help quality of life in that way as well. It's a very different way of thinking about things. But this is a model that helps me understand family violence a little bit better. We should also keep in mind, though, that there are protective factors, that some people go through these traumas and don't end up in cycles of violence, that some people who are under incredibly stressful situations never end up hitting or punching or kicking. So what do we know? People who have high-quality childcare may be able to get a break a little bit. People who are in healthy relationships. I had wonderful grandparents, and I adored my grandparents, and we got along really well. So when I first became a geriatrician, whenever somebody would come in and say, my grandson has moved in with me, I would go, that is so sweet. And they would always go, yes, it's wonderful. And then as I started learning more about elder abuse, every time somebody said, my grandson is moving in with me, I kept it very neutral, and I said, oh, what do you think about that? And it wasn't until I changed how I was responding that I started to hear things like, well, I'm a little bit worried because he just got out of prison. Never heard that when I would say, that's so sweet, right? So we need to understand how what we do as healthcare providers influences what people are telling us, and how to learn from the studies that we're doing so that it changes our practices for the better as well. But these are all kinds of protective factors that we can help get by working with individuals and working in our communities and working in society, healthier relationships, social supports, the idea of resilience, providing people with access to healthcare. So those were just a few kind of trends and demographics that I don't think get talked about very much that I wanted to bring to your attention. And I wanted to close with just a couple of ideas and an appreciation for the folks who are out there, funders and people in foundations. The opportunity that foundations have, that grant makers have, to advocate for cross-sector collaborations, to help us translate science into practice, to provide quality training for caregivers. This now starts to help with resiliency and social supports, to help with research, to empower and engage, and to make people like me empower and engage with our communities. I'll just tell you, on my end, sometimes it feels like when I'm talking to funders, you know, it's like, okay, well, you want better outcomes and higher quality, and you want it all at lower cost. You want me to be innovative. You want a good return on your investment. It needs to be scalable, and it better be sustainable, too. So that's good. And I get it, and I'll try my best. We can't always do that, right? So not all programs are suitable for expansion. Not everything really is scaled, or should it be scaled. Sometimes things really are local, and they work there because it's so well designed for that particular spot. Sometimes the innovation isn't the program, but how you're applying somebody else's program to what you're doing, or how you're coordinating things. And so this is where I think sometimes the struggles can come in. Sometimes, and I think this is one way that funders have been so helpful to me, it's like sometimes I don't know exactly how to get something done, but I know why we need to do something. and we can start really trying to figure out, stick to the why, like, why do I know that there's a problem here? And what can we do to try to make it better? And sometimes the funding is what's going to help us be able to figure that out. So the power of foundations, I think, to, you can help folks like me make collaborations we never would have thought that we would have been making. Now, this was not an easy picture to take, so I hope you're all appreciative of that. Can you all read that? So, and this is another place where I've seen foundations be so powerful. To be able to come in, I still remember when Mary Ellen Coleman from the Archstone Foundation sat with me. I was trying to convince our local area in Orange County, California, to start this weird thing that we were calling an Elder Abuse Forensic Center. And they were all looking at me like this. But there was the Archstone Foundation by my side and saying, you know, this system might not accommodate it, but sat side by side with me with some of the most important people in the county, people I never would have gotten appointments with without them. But because of the power of Mary Ellen and the Archstone Foundation, they were able to get people in the room to say, well, we got to change the system and help us get that done. And that then started an incredible sequence of events. There are now centers like that all around the country, really due to Mary Ellen and the Archstone Foundation. And then I want to just like do a shout out related to the good, the bad, and the ugly. The other thing I think that foundations and grant makers are so helpful with is helping us take a risk. That we can have something and it might turn out to be good, but you're still going to love us if it turns out to be bad or ugly. It's going to allow us to take a risk on something that may not work. Yet what I have found time and time again, if it's the right people that you're working with, even if it doesn't work, there is so much to be learned from, quote, failure, that may end up coming back and being helpful years down the line, or may end up being helpful to somebody else. So somebody in Texas, you know, you could say, hey, I did that and it didn't work. Let me tell you about why it didn't work and be able to help others. And you give us that ability to take risks and not always for it to work out well, which I'm hugely grateful for. I'm 58 years old, so I've been around for a while and I've been the beneficiary of some of the work of folks like you for a very long time. You know, 30 years ago, it was a more of a transactional kind of thing between us coming to you with a really good idea and then maybe you providing us with funds to do it. But now what I've noticed is it's much more collaborative. You're coming, you as funders are coming to folks like me and saying, hey, we have ideas, we want to participate. And even though that sometimes can be more difficult, it has just, I think, made my work so much better to have people who are so smart about so many other things that I don't know about push me, help me think about things in different ways, bring me together with other folks as well. So I just wanted to end by saying thank you for the help that you certainly have given to me personally. I know that groups like California Healthcare Foundation, the John A. Hartford Foundation, the Archstone Foundation have been completely key to my career. The fact that I am now the dean of a major research university is insane. But it really has everything to do with the key moments in which foundations came and supported me in both in terms of career growth and in terms of program growth and in helping me think things through. So it really has been an honor for me to come and talk to you. It's at least a way for me to say thank you to all of you. And I thank you for your attention. We have a few minutes for Q&A if you'd like that now. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.